Hi, I'm Kaylee, a college student and pretend journalist who was conceived with donor sperm in 1999. This is Message in a Bottle. Hi, welcome to episode 13. I took a week off because it was my spring break and I was visiting my boyfriend and his family. I will give a shout out to his mom, Joy, who is a really special person and is a big fan of the show. So, hi, Joy. What you're about to hear is my conversation with Eric, who is a donor-conceived person of color who reached out to me a while back to tell me about his different experiences and a support group for DC BIPOC that he attends. I really wanted to give him a platform to share because I've noticed that the online donor-conceived space is mostly white, and the intersection between being donor-conceived and being a person of color just, like, is not discussed enough. I'm white, so obviously I'm not going to speak from firsthand experience, and I don't want to speak over people, but I do think that these issues are important and definitely deserve to be part of the conversations had about advocating for the rights of the donor-conceived. There are lots of parts to this. For one thing, the vast majority of both sperm and egg donors are white. The majority of people who buy gametes are also white. My parents purchased me from California Cryobank, one of the largest in the world, and literally four of their donors are black. Like, as of today, I checked the website. It's just crazy. It just really limits the options for non-white customers who are looking to have non-white kids. We have to think about why people of color are far less likely to donate and buy gametes. I was recently reading about the fact that statistically, black women are far more likely to experience fertility issues, but are far less likely to seek treatment. The U.S. has a long and ugly history of using non-white patients for inhumane medical experimentation, so there's a lot of valid apprehension and mistrust and avoidance there, and not to mention medical racism is still very much alive and well. And obviously the process of buying eggs or sperm and going through the treatment is expensive as fuck and usually is not covered by insurance, so there are racial access barriers because of socioeconomic disparities and so on. But okay, if I keep talking, you will never hear from Eric, so I'm gonna stop, but I will quickly remind you to follow the show wherever you're listening to, on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or whatever, and to follow on Instagram at Message in a Bottle Podcast.
Hi.
Hey. Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing well. And you?
Pretty good.
I just got done podcasting like an hour and a half ago. So we're going into this one as well. So it's just nonstop podcast day, which is fun.
Do you have your own, or you mean being on somebody else's?
I do. We have a totally unrelated podcast to what we're going to talk about. It's football, like the one you use your foot with, soccer.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been doing that for what started actually as a radio show, but then obviously with COVID the studio shut down for a while, and we moved to podcast format, and we've stayed there ever since for about 2 years. So in total it's been about 4 years of the program, but 2 years as a podcast.
Oh wow, that's cool.
Yep, it was a long one. We had a guest, and so it's kind of like a double, like the interview, and then we did our coverage section. So it went a little longer than expected. I'm like, damn, I gotta eat, do some other stuff, and then do the next one.
Okay, so I guess I will just ask you to introduce yourself to the listeners, and you know where you're from, how old you are, and just explain a little bit about what you had initially emailed me. About your
there's lots of different entry points depending on what we're going to talk about and where we're going to go and all the intersections and things. But to start off, my name is Eric. I'm in the Twin Cities here, Minneapolis, 42 years old, and I guess if we start with the donor conceived section, that's more of a typical late discovery donor conceived story. You've probably heard it before.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, picked up the DNA kit as a, actually I received it as a gift, 2017 into 2018 Christmas holiday. And it was more of a curiosity thing. My partner had heard, she knows, and other people know too, that, you know, I, on the Brazilian side, so I have a white Euro settler dad, mm-hmm. and then I have a brown, extremely mixed, we'd say mestiça or mestiça mom, who, you know, the roots are all tangled. Like on one side, I had like a family tree, I used to like to say, and on the other side, I have more of a family vine. It's just a complete mess. You know what I'm saying? So it was mostly to look at that side and untangle some of that vine, because yeah. there was no question there that there was African and indigenous ancestry there. It's just a matter of how much, where, and getting a few more details on that, on those points. So that was the whole impetus for the thing. And so I got it 2017 and then got the results in 2018. Important to note here, I would say that this happened in a relative's house in the suburbs of Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And my parents were there. My parents saw me open the box.
Yep.
So there was ample opportunity at this moment to get ahead of it. And
yeah, to say something. Exactly.
They did not. And so you fast forward a few months, did the spit in the tube, sent it out, got it back. And the results weren't initially like too shocking. Like it was cool to see the level of detail on the Brazilian side in a way that was a lot more clear with actual percentages about, well, it's not so important. It was just neat to see how it all panned out. But then I noticed, you know, that there was just the whole narrative on my dad's side, social dad's side, that it was extremely well documented that my grandmother was of this French German Alsace region. And I actually had a copy of, I think it would have been like a great, maybe three great generation of the uncle that immigrated. I had the passport. Mm-hmm. And then on the grandfather's side, they were Mennonites from what's now Switzerland. You know, many years ago, it wasn't that. And they kept getting essentially exiled and booted out of country, until they ended up in what's now Holland, where they met a guy named Penn that happened to have a state named after him now, right?
Oh, wow.
So that's how they, yeah, exactly. And that's how they pieced out from there to what is now Pennsylvania. So that was like clear, like really, really well documented. And none of that showed up.
Right.
Zero. You know what I'm saying? It was like, huh, interesting. There was Dutch, but what we were led to believe was that we were German Swiss, mm-hmm. right? But I, you know, the mind processes, and I was thinking, well, maybe that, you know, since they landed for a little bit in Holland, for however long that was, maybe there was something there. And so, you know, I let it sit for a while, but it, you know, it didn't take that long to start to notice that, again, as you've heard, common story, the DNA relatives pop up. This is 23andMe, by the way. And there were three, I believe it was, that were shown as half siblings, one of whom immediately wrote, and to her credit, was very gentle and was very inquisitive. Do you know why this is happening? Blah, blah, blah. Oh, I don't know you. Do, 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 do. And it took a while. Like it took a few messages before she really got into it, I should say, and kind of laid it all out. And again, as you and the listeners have heard by this point, it was destabilizing. It was really shocking. It was, it was a mind fuck is the only mm-hmm. word I could really ever come up with. It just stopped everything, really messed me up for a while. And I didn't know what to do with that information. This is now like spring of 2018. Mm-hmm. And so being that I have grown up in the Midwest of this country and the Midwest of Brazil, and they share some similarities in this respect, where You don't talk about your feelings, so you just bottle that shit up and throw it away. Uh-huh. And that's what I did. I did that for 3 years.
Well, okay, so you grew up in Brazil.
Back and forth.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Born in Nebraska, and then my mom is from, you could say, the Nebraska of Brazil, state of Goiás.
That's funny. So you didn't say anything for 3 years to your parents?
I mean, not to my parents, no. So my partner has been along with me in the journey forever, throughout the whole thing. And I didn't have the vocabulary. I wasn't sure what to do with it, processing all these things. And again, to their credit, the siblings were very cool. They were very patient. There was nothing pushy or, I don't know, there was no expectation, as it were, you know. They literally let it simmer for 3 years, which, you know, in retrospect, now that we're building this relationship, is kind of a cool thing that they just let it be. So let's see here, maybe I can keep moving. During this time period of just letting it be and simmer, as I said, you and everybody else listening knows that we had a pretty monumental revolutionary incident here in our community with the police lynching of George Floyd. I won't disclose my exact location, but I can tell you I'm not very far from where it occurred. Mm-hmm. I've been active in a lot of radical left-wing organizations and been to my very fair share of actions and protests and things like that. Mm-hmm. Throughout my time here in the Twin Cities, and immediately this one felt different. I mean, I can still, it's funny because it doesn't feel like it was that long ago, but at the same time, when I start to think about it, it's like, oh man, it was a trip, because we got there on, it was Memorial Day when this happened.
2020, years ago. Wow.
Exactly. Memorial Day 2020. And the message just started coming in. You got to get down, hold space. And we were still ciphering through getting all the information. And then the march started. And like, so far at this point, it was pretty routine. Like I've seen this many, many times. I saw a lot of the same faces. I was communicating with a lot of the same people. But then when it, you know, we started moving and I'm like, all right, where are we going? And it kind of started to filter through. We're headed straight to the precinct. And I'm like, okay, that's bold. That's interesting. So we'll see where this goes. And I mean, you know, I'm a father. I'm a little bit older now. I did a little more daring things when I was probably your age, in my 20s, even into my 30s. So I got to kind of keep myself a little bit in check. It's not going to help anybody if I get arrested or if I get hurt in these respects. So I've got to just be a little more attentive to not just my needs, but the needs of the family and things like that. You know what I'm saying? So once we got there, you know, the standoff started and the tear gas started flying. You've all seen at this point, everything that's kind of, that took place starting from there. And holding that space was exceptional. I mean, it was really an incredible thing. Like before this, I mean, I could go on and on about MPD in this city or any city, but we had another police lynching in 2016 of a young man named Jamar Clark. And we held some space there in that community as well. And I think we learned a lot from that experience to kind of adapt it to what was going to happen and what was going to transpire with this one, to the point where here we are, like you said, almost 3 years later, and we still have that space. Like George Floyd Square still exists, which is pretty remarkable that we kind of carved out this semi-autonomous community within the middle of the city.
Has it been named that?
GFS. Yep.
Oh, George
Floyd Square.
I didn't know that.
Yep. We did a lot to fortify. I mean, we made barricades. We set up different community centers. There's a clothing store, not even a store. It's a come and take type of thing. There's daily meetings. Like I'm not as directly involved as I was initially, or, you know, parent responsibilities or anything like that, but it is a, you know, kind of a fully integrated community. And I guess I bring this part up just to say that, you know, you're going to go against the cops, you're going to go against the state, you're going to go against all these institutions. It kind of takes its toll, whether it's going to be a few weeks or months, or in this case, years. And between that and the stresses of pandemic isolation, it just hit pretty hard, like 2020 something. Maybe we were into 2021 at this point. And I just knew I needed to talk to somebody. I needed some help. It was starting to stress the family relationships, and I just knew that I wasn't in a good headspace either. So that's when I started actually. Those were my essential reasons to go to therapy or go back to therapy. It's been a mm-hmm. long time, and so that's kind of where we started. And then it spiraled. Not really spiraled, but I mentioned it as a offhanded comment almost. And I have a very astute, awesome therapist, and she kind of caught it. She's like, "Wait, what's this thing about the DNA test or whatever?" And so I elaborated on that. She's just like, "Whoa! We gotta spend some time here."
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? She's like, "She's good. She's great. She's wonderful." And so that then became a huge focus of our work. Which then led to kind of fast forwarding through to the summer of 2021, pretty recently, mm-hmm. where I did finally have a conversation with my parents through the tools of what we worked through in therapy, kind of getting it all laid out. And that was fucking terrible. I mean, that was tough. It was really tough.
So how really did they tough. React?
It was mixed. Mixed reaction. My dad kind of gave it away. Like there was dead silence for a little while, and it was more of a look than anything that he even said, that I was just like, okay, this is real. This is the truth. And then he started to show a little bit of empathy and a little remorse that he'd held it this long. He even mentioned that he'd thought many times about telling me, mm-hmm. I never did. So just even having a little bit of empathy and sympathy was kind of nice to see. My mom, on the other hand, was extremely combative, mm-hmm. and didn't believe, you know, what are these tests? Are they real results? Blah blah. You've heard it before, right?
Yeah.
You're gonna fight the biology. Let's fight the DNA and see. Yeah. That was the vibe. And it took a little while for her to come around to the whole thing. She, you know, we got the I just forgot, I think is kind of what she said. And yeah, exactly.
So did you ever get the like story of how it happened and all of that?
Sort of not really. I mean, I've got it now through the other siblings. Mm-hmm. But I can piece enough things together from hearing other stories that, again, I think it lines up pretty consistently with just, I mean, my dad, he did say low sperm count, infertility issues, but you know, that's kind of where it ended. But I know the clinic now. I know, we know the donor, or at least where this person's at. Mm-hmm. The gamete profiteer is the new term that I'm throwing around, the GP. Feel free to spread that one.
That's fun.
Yeah. And, you know, as an anti-capitalist, an anti-fascist, I had to like use that framework to kind of look through all this stuff. And I'm just like, donor doesn't work for me. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
There's no donation happening. You're getting paid.
Yeah, it's no. A misnomer.
Correct. So gamete profiteers is the one I came up with. But we have that information now. And it's, you know, it's still kind of a work in progress. It's tough because I think my mom really wants to bottle it back up and throw it away, pretend it never happened, put the genie back in the bottle, as it were. But, you know, work in progress.
Yeah. So the donor, or, you know, in quotes, is white.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay.
Yep. I think they, you know, again, similar story, wanted to find somebody similar enough that with his look or traits, don't know if that's really the case, because I have seen a photo and I'm like, maybe.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So that would lead back then, circling back to the Dutch that like came out of nowhere as like a substantial amount, like 40% or whatever it is.
Yeah. So then when you initially wrote to me, you were talking about this group that you go to.
Yep.
So will you tell me about
that? Yeah, of course. The DC BIPOC or BIPOC DCP, I think I use both of them interchangeably. We're all kind of just working this thing out, figuring it out together. But it started through we found each other is really what happened. We found each other in the We Are Donor Conceived group on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And I left Facebook. I didn't leave Facebook because of that group. It was part of a therapy thing. Like, I got out of most of my social media, so I don't have Facebook or Twitter anymore. It's been great. But that was a hard one, because one of the main reasons I was still on Facebook was for that group, mm-hmm. just to like hear the stories and build some solidarity with the people there. And that's kind of the beautiful thing that grew and flourished from there, is there were probably a handful of us, I mean, less than 10, that kind of found one another. We kind of started to realize that, you know, there was a heavy, again, white Euro settler presence here that wasn't necessarily reflecting a lot of the intersections that those of us that would define ourselves as BIPOC or people of color were confronting while still being DC. And when some people tried, they were actively shut down with, you know, what you can imagine, just white privilege and even tiptoeing into some white supremacist kind of stuff within that group. So we kind of decided to just hang a little bit more and started with just like a chat group, and became something more, became something to the point where, yeah, we meet weekly. Oh. That's a smaller group. That's through the DCC, the Donor Conceived Community. I'll try to be the ambassador for a second. So if anybody is listening to this and you consider yourself BIPOC, DCP, DCP, BIPOC, by all means, you reach out to me or reach out to the DCC, and we'll get you kind of connected and hooked up, because it's a really good place. And as you know from everybody on your program, there's these through lines through all of our stories that are very similar, but at the same time, no story is the same. Mm-hmm. And that's very much the case with us as well. For example, I mean, I was speaking on my behalf, or speaking about my story, at least. For me, it's more about growing up in a very, very, again, white Euro settler state, and being a person of color and not having necessarily a lot of the tools to navigate that and dealing with violent racism and violent racist attacks. And there's other people that are there as well. But then on the other side, there are what's, I think, for your generation. And by the way, side note, you all are awesome. I think where you're at in your life, and the fact that you knew and you were told and you have these tools, like, I'm kind of inspired by you and everybody in your positions in your generation. So I'm kind of like holding on to the tails, as it were, as you all kind of like plow through and speed through all this stuff. And I learn a lot from you all, and I learn a lot from your program, and I really appreciate you. You're welcome. But as I was saying, yeah, so there's like the anti-racist element of it, and those of us that had to confront that stuff. And there's also this newer element, again, to the newer generations, where for a long time during my lifetime, like, there was just no option to have a donor of color. Like, that just didn't exist,
right?
And I know you've already talked about the eugenics tie, and there you go, it's a huge part of it. But there's many of us in this group that, again, your age, your generation, that do have donors of color, and so it's, for me, it's super enlightening and super interesting to hear their perspectives. Mm-hmm. Particularly if you're a somewhat late or late discovery, and you're told that you're one ethnicity, right? And then you come to find out that you're something completely different.
Yeah.
I mean, I think about the mind fuck and the destabilization that I went through just with my things. Like, getting, can you imagine having that on top of the other thing? That's, I can't even imagine. I don't even have the words.
Right. Cause it's, your parent isn't who you your parent is different than who you thought it was, and who you are in terms of like racial or ethnic identity is entirely different. So it's like, how do you how do you make sense of that? I can't even imagine that.
That's right, exactly. And so it's not just this thing with, well, I'll go learn Dutch or learn French or German, or is this like, this is a completely different ethnicity now.
Yeah.
Nationality and ethnicity, which wherever you want to tie it in. And I mean, that's heavy, really, really heavy. And so listening to some of those folks in the crew, I mean, I can sit there and empathize and be an ear, but man, it's rough. It's really rough. And so we have these kind of entry points within the group, I suppose. And it's open to everything and anything in between.
Yeah. So you meet online or you meet in person?
Online. Yep. Yeah.
That's very cool.
Yeah. I mean, I still haven't even met in person any of my siblings, which I'm kind of jealous listening to your story and some of the other ones where you guys were able to make that happen pre-pandemic. All this stuff has happened to me throughout the pandemic. So we meet regularly, like our sibling group. There's seven of us that are in regular contact of 12. That includes my social sister and the two, the gamete profiteers, social kids that don't know we exist. Yep. And then there's two that have kind of fallen out. So when you start to do the math, we get down to that seven number where we're at.
But so your social sister is a full sibling.
Okay. Interesting point. She's not.
Okay.
So that is another thing that did come out. And I guess I kind of have to take my parents at their word, although it's trickier now, obviously going through this.
Yeah.
But they had really no reason to push this kind of a lie. And it came from my dad too, which made it a little bit more sincere, I believe. I guess she was kind of the surprise, as it were. So they tried for a long time. I don't want to speak too much about their story because that's like their story and not mine, you know what I'm saying? But there's a 7-year gap between when they're married and when I'm born. And part of it is, you know, it's an international marriage. They're traveling a lot, which is true. They're living their lives. They're doing the same. All that is true. But then the big facet of this that was left out is that they were actively trying to have a child over 7 years and it never happened. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's where the DC part of my story comes in. For whatever reason, as it sometimes happens, right, they weren't thinking about it. They were chill. Things start working. My sister was born.
Yeah. I've heard of that happening where you have a first child who's like adopted. That's what I've heard. And then you get pregnant after that. And it's like, oh, well, maybe it's because you're not as stressed about.
Right.
Yeah. So that's not an uncommon thing, but that is interesting.
Yep. Yep. So technically she's a half sib as well in this whole thing. And that was a whole situation as well. It took a long time between getting everything out on the table that summer last year, and then a number of months before we were able to have the conversation and let my sister know. Again, my mom shut it down. She did not want my sister to know, which then put this other burden, like, now I'm a part of the lie. Yeah, it's fucked up, right? It's not a part of it.
It puts so the onus of all of this, like, responsibility is put so much on you're not a child, but the donor conceived person, where it's like you have to navigate, do you want to contact this person, what will they think, blah blah blah. It's like, why is it on you, like, to keep secrets and whatnot?
There's so much narcissism and just so much that's the word, right? That's it right there. So that was terrible, because like, now it's on me, and like, I want to tell my children, but we're not going to tell my children and then have to like have them hold the secret from their chia. Like, that's terrible. We don't want to do that. We don't put them in that position. Whole other thing. But anyway, eventually it got there. I got there around Thanksgiving, and we had a really good conversation. She was really empathetic. She was very sad, obviously, for everyone involved, but she was very cool about it. As was my cousin, who, I mean, technically I'm not related to at all, but I still consider them family. It's kind of an interesting dynamic of deciding who's family and who's a relative at this point, which you can probably relate to. And I mean, he's like my brother. Like, we grew up together. So like, I love that guy to death. Like, he'd take a bullet for me, and likewise. And he gave me the reaction that I would have loved to have gotten from my mom. You know what I'm saying? Like he was awesome. He still is. So that was nice to hear from him.
Yeah. It's interesting what you were saying about the uptick of donors of color and how that changes the kind of dynamics of like how this all works. I mean, I was reading some stuff, and yeah, there are definitely some like in the major banks and stuff, but it's so much less common to find a non-white donor, which is just
no question.
Yeah.
But having said that, I mean, at present where we're at, or with your generation, right, there was at least an option. Whereas like you go back to the late 70s and 80s, like where our crew is from, it's not even an option. Like you don't even, why would you even try?
Yeah. Yeah. It's still, I don't know if I even understand the reasoning behind that. Like the donors themselves, like why is it such a smaller percentage of non-white donors in these big banks? Like I almost don't even know if I have an explanation.
It's a good question. I mean, partially we can probably look back in history again from a kind of an anti-racist, anti-fascist lens and just think about the medical community and all the horrors they've done to people of color, not just in this country, but in any European colonized land. So I put that at the front as a huge reason, just skepticism.
Yeah, and not wanting to get involved with doctors and stuff when you don't have to.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But that's probably not all it. I'm sure there's other reasons as well.
Yeah.
What we find now, or what I'm learning and finding out through the community, obviously there's a lot of, where it's common, I should say, I don't want to make too big of a generalization here, but there are a number of East Asian doctors, right? Mm-hmm. And it's becoming a little bit more common, I would say, to find East Asian donors.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And then I think it probably does have something to do with the donors, and that population is somewhat related to the clientele of a bank, like who is buying sperm or eggs, mm-hmm. and how that's related to, like, there's just access barriers of that because it is so expensive, and the connection between like who exactly has the money or the, yeah, I guess just the resources to invest in all of that. And it's a lot of it is just like very wealthy white people, Jewish people, all of that compared to, you know, so that's probably part of it as well. I don't know.
Totally. No, I think you're spot on.
Yeah. I was reading about how the majority of the people that work at these banks, though, are non-white, which I think is interesting.
That is
like interesting. And how that is related to, like, and how they, I can't remember what I was reading about, how the putting people of color in the leadership positions at these different banks has increased the amount of people of color donating and also buying it, which makes sense. But
that's interesting.
Yeah.
So as they get promoted up, they kind of become the face or the figurehead or whatever, and people get more comfortable just knowing that there's a POC that might be talking to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Selling it, as it were.
Yeah, selling it.
Ah, capitalism.
I know, it's awful. I blame the entire, all of the problems within the whole industry on money. Like, I think that is definitely what it comes down to.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, what I've learned as well, specifically, I have a doctor cousin in Brazil. And so she and I have been vibing quite a bit since this
doctor discovery. Cousin. Oh, like a cousin who is a doctor.
Cousin who's a doctor. Yeah. Right. Sorry.
I'm like, what's the doctor cousin?
but she's an endocrinologist. So she's tangentially touching on some of these things, but not necessarily directly, but she knows a lot. And so she's like, oh yeah, here in Brazil, nobody gets paid. I'm like, oh yeah, that's, so it really is a literal donor conception, mm-hmm. where you're doing it. And I know there's other places that are like that as well, following like the laws in Australia and in Europe and things. changing in some of those other places, but not everywhere, certainly not here.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet a lot less people would do it if you didn't get anything out of it.
Now, having said that, because there's still a lot of conservatism in Brazil and all of Latin America, very, you know, Catholic guilt, all that stuff, it's still very closeted in a lot of ways. Like, very few people like to talk about it. And I think that that idea of don't say anything, don't tell, is still very much pushed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is interesting to compare the different, the social, like, stigma around certain things, because it is trending more towards openness in America, like the
right
earlier disclosure type of stuff. But then I also think that that has to do with the fact that, like, from the cryobank that I'm from, 80% of the people that buy the sperm are lesbians or, like, you know, non-straight couples. So with the gay parents thing, it obviously changes the dynamic of the fact that you kind of have to explain.
And I think we owe, at least speaking for myself, I think we owe a huge gratitude to the queer community for for doing what they've been doing. And like you said, there's not really an option, and you have to be upfront and out front about it, and good on them, because it's finally starting to push the cishet community to do the same damn thing after,
yeah,
like,
I think so,
5 decades or however long it's been. But do we get there without the queer folks? I don't think so. I'm not sure. So at least me speaking, I'm like, yo, thank you so much, because it's finally starting to move the ball. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think that that's a good point. It does impact the general, like, yeah, exactly, the way that cishet couples conceptualize, like, it just normalizes it in general. So it makes people feel more comfortable to tell their kids.
It's a trip. You mentioned you said something about the family or expectations or something. I don't know. It just brought something to mind of how it's been so hard for my mom to, like, come to grips with this. But, like, my Brazilian family, Kaylee, is just, you know what a telenovela is, right?
Yeah, like a soap opera.
Yes. Or we call it, like, a novela in Portuguese. It's the same thing. Like, my Brazilian side is a telenovela. It's a novela. It is just, like, insane, like, nonstop, like, all the batshit stuff you would see in your telenovela de las ocho, das nove, whatever it is, like, that's my family. So, like, it is, like, I'm talking, like, you know, parents coming and going, baby daddy's in, baby daddy's out, like, that whole mess. Like, I'm talking some mild incest shit happening. I'm talking, oh yeah, I'm talking, like, oh, low drug
what
dealing.
Is mild talking, incest, like,
yeah, I know exactly. Cousins, how about cousins?
Okay.
Like, low drug dealing to, like, the point of one of my cousins, this just happened just recently. Like, every time I go back, it's like I get sat down by some of my other family, and it's just kind of like, you know how you do, like, your recap of your Netflix show of, like, this is what you missed last season. Mm-hmm. That's like the first hour and a half of talking to my cousins, like, all this fucked up shit happened over the past, like, year. Because it's always something. And so that's what it was this last time. It was like a cousin of mine, he got his pilot license, he was doing his thing, and he got wrapped into a cartel, and he's piloting a plane full of who knows how many tons of drugs, and he's up in the air, and the Brazilian Air Force find him and basically say, you have 2 minutes to land this plane or we're blowing you the fuck out of the air. Like, this is my family.
That's wild.
This is my family. You understand? So, like, that she would think that there's, like, this traditional whatever super conservative idea of family when there have been NPEs for everywhere for the past decades within this family, it's kind of ridiculous when I think about it now, because it's just been there always. But for whatever reason, between her and I and what and this construct, it's something different. It means something different to her. It's very strange.
Yeah, it is interesting, because I feel like, yeah, that's a good point, where it's not like you have this buttoned up super conservative family and it's like the secret. Yeah, because if it's happening in other forms all over the place, it's like,
it's a telenovela, girl. It's a novella. You know what I'm saying? It's like I remember all these dudes just in and out all the time when I was a kid, and like my aunties would have, my chias would have to raise my cousins, because just like the dads were nowhere and they would never show up, and like that's common.
Yeah, Yeah, and also I feel like I've heard people express that it's usually the non-biological social parent that has a sort of harder time with maybe talking about it, or when it finally comes out, like dealing with that and the consequences of that. Like growing up, my two moms, the one who is my non-biological mom, seems slightly more sensitive to the whole issue and feeling a little bit more uncomfortable, just because it's that aspect of like you feel like you're being replaced or something.
Right.
So I found that. But then when we actually found the donor, quote, it was my biological mom that felt, I think, more uncomfortable in the beginning, which is interesting. So it's interesting because your mom is your biological mom. So it's not the aspect of like she feels like she's being replaced or misunderstood. So that is
yeah, it really is. And you know, there's so little I can do. I can only suggest that she get some help. I think therapy would work wonders for her. I'm sure you know Jana Rapno at this point. I'd love for her to talk to her and meet her at some point, because I think she'd be wonderful. But that generation's tough. Like they're very set in their ways. They're very stubborn. And I don't trust that she's going to do anything. I mean, maybe, but not really. My dad, on the other hand, you know, he met me halfway from the jump. Like he showed remorse. He showed regret. He talked about, I feel like some weight has been lifted here. I'm like, okay, I can work with that. That's validating. Exactly. It's validating. You're giving me something to work with. And yeah, it's been a struggle with her though. It's getting better, like little by little, but I mean, I know she doesn't want to talk about it. So now it's just like, what, for the next however many years, decades we've got, like we're just gonna like dance around this issue or whatever. I'm just like, it's gonna be interesting. I don't know.
Yeah, that's hard. You said something a while ago that I would ask. So you said about in the Facebook groups about when people of color post about that aspect of it, people have weird responses. So what do you mean?
Yeah. Well, okay, I don't want to speak for, I gotta be careful how I
I know. That. All of these conversations are like, I don't mean to speak, you know, that's the whole thing.
Yeah.
You're individual.
So I'll speak in very general terms that there is, I don't think it would be too surprising to hear that there's a lot of white privilege from a mostly white settler descendant group in these groups, and not just that one, but all of them. And so when BIPOC folks or POC, however you want to describe it, bring something to the table that might make some of these other people feel a little bit uncomfortable, we get that white fragility. You know what I'm saying? Even if it's in this group. And so a lot of people, not a lot, but some of the people that are in this group that I'm in, felt that tension and felt that stress and felt that this discomfort, as it were, that maybe they're not being as welcomed as they would like to be, which is another reason why we were able to kind of build this thing that we're building. I want to be really clear though, that for the WADC group, it was wonderful for me personally. Like it was a great starting point, like getting through all this shit, because it was really, really hard for me for the first, I don't know, 5 or 6 months, and having that group and having a base of solidarity and hearing those stories. And I'm still in contact with a lot of those people, even though I'm no longer on Facebook. Like they were wonderful. They're wonderful. So I want to say that, you know, up front, that it was very good for me. But again, having said that, it's tough. It's tough when you are, how do you say, like a minority within a minority. How about that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a small, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, that definitely adds a layer to it that I don't think people, that's annoying that when I say people, I mean white people. When that white people, I guess, don't think about or consider or really talk about it. Like, I don't see a lot of, I don't see that aspect being talked about or acknowledged, I guess, like in, not on purpose, but it's just like, because it's a minority within a minority, like I don't see it acknowledged much in that Facebook group or any of the ones that I'm in, or even like the Instagram space. Like, I feel like that's not something that I've
noticed. It's funny you mentioned that, because there's talk. We're thinking about doing something there eventually. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you should.
I'm trying to think where I want to go with it, but so one thing I will say, I don't want to push too many buttons, but there was something brought up at one point about DCP, donor conceived people, looking for status as like an ethnic minority or a minority group. And we need to be very, very careful with this, I think, because this, first of all, this is probably coming from a place of privilege and probably from a place of white privilege and with a shot of white supremacy in there as well. And I mean, if you do not identify as a BIPOC person or a person of color or have some other, I mean, we throw Jewish folks in here as well. If you haven't experienced racism, if you haven't experienced any form of discrimination, whether it's socioeconomic, education, housing, the list goes on and on. If you haven't stood toe-to-toe with a Nazi that literally wants to wipe you off the face of the earth, this has happened to me many times, okay? If you haven't had those kind of experiences, you got to pull back. You got to take a step back. These are very particular and sensitive issues that are very specific to people that are under threat. And if you have white privilege, right? If you are a white settler descendant, full 100%, you're okay at the end of the day. You know what I'm saying? You still get to walk in that white skin. You're going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 90% European. But that 10% plus the 30% Iberian, which puts me at like 40 some percent, not traditional, whitey Northern European, that is enough for me to be misidentified and for me to be attacked. And it has happened. You know what I'm saying? I can't control that shit, but welcome to a white supremacist settler colonial land anywhere, whether it's here or Brazil or, you know, from Alaska to Tierra del Fuego, all the islands in between. Unfortunately, it's the sad state that we're in.
Yeah.
But again, if you are a white settler, full descended DCP, I'm sorry, but you are not an ethnic minority.
Yeah, wait, why would people think that they were an ethnic minority?
It was floating around. It was floating around in one of the groups that they were looking
ethnic
for, like
minority.
Something like that, that it came out like we want status similar to being like.
Oh, like, know, comparing.
Right, right.
Oh,
we are like this.
Yes, yes, I see what you're saying. Oh, yeah, nope.
Because right?
Yeah, nope. New. Because it's just totally different. Like,
I didn't.
You can look at somebody who's white and not know that their mom used a sperm donor. Like, how would you even possibly know that? Whereas it's just obviously not the same.
I wasn't even, I was out of Facebook at this time, so I never saw where it started, but it trickled into our chat and just like caught fire and exploded. I'm just like, oh fuck, this is not good.
Yeah, that's kind of a crazy thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, if you want to talk about some of my experiences that I've had, I don't know, but
yeah,
some of the highlights of the horrors of racism in my life, I suppose. One of the earliest memories I have, I was about 11 years old. This was in Nebraska. And I was called over. I was in a gym at a YWCA. And I was the only brown kid in there. And it was a friend, but then there were like two or three other older kids, again, white Euro settler kids, wrestlers. And they brought me over and I was just like, you know, like anybody else, I'm looking for some acceptance and hang with the cool kids or whatever. So I went over to chat. And while we were chatting, I didn't really realize what happened. I hadn't had any martial arts or combat training at that point. I do now. I was choked. I was putting what we call now a mataleo, rear naked choke, like you see in MMA. And basically came very close to being choked unconscious. I don't remember much of it because I was almost out. No reason, just for the fuck of it, because they could get away with it, which they did. But at the very least, the kid that kind of roped me into it, this was all planned, obviously. Like this, I think maybe you could even consider this a hate crime at this point. I'm not sure how far you want to go with it, but it was very, very thought out and planned. So this kid was my bait that brought me into it. And he realized really quickly this was going south because who knows what can happen if I go out. So he was able to stop the other older kids before I was fully out. But I walked down the stairs once I regained consciousness fully, and I signed up for Taekwondo right there. Said, this has never happened to me ever again. And so I've been on and off with martial arts for like the last 3 decades, because that's it. I was never gonna let that happen again. It's been mostly like jujitsu and the Muay Thai MMA kind of stuff for like the past decade. But I mean, that's kind of where it started. And even there, it can get a little dicey with, it's a whole nother conversation with racism and white supremacy. But yeah, that was one of those memories that I really suppressed too, because I had this idea of, you know, I'd watched a lot of action movies and my cousin was doing it too. And it was just like, oh, I just want to give it a try. But through, I've been writing through therapy, and I've got like 20 pages of, or 20,000 words of whatever this thing is going to be, whether it's a book or who knows. But that came up and I'm just like, oh damn, I really pushed that one way back there as well. Cause that was like a defining moment too, where it was just like, literally my subconscious was just like, you will die if you don't know how to take care of yourself.
Yeah. That's young. That's scary. Definitely. Yeah.
So that led to that. It's funny to think about identity crises throughout life, but with this DCP thing now as the latest one, but I've had so many more tied to race and ethnic, just misnomers or identifications, as it were, you know, like people thinking you're something that you're not, but the societal perception of whatever you are, right? That kind of a thing. From like in the 90s, once NAFTA like hit, we were in a really, really heavy meatpacking part of the state. So we had a huge influx of Mexican and Central American workers that were obviously deeply, deeply oppressed and taken advantage of as cheap labor. But a lot of them became my friends, and I played football with a lot of them. So we became friends mostly on the pitch. But then, you know, when, if a racist wants to start shit, they're not going to ask you for the details of your
heritage. Ethnic. Yeah. Before that's they right. call you. Yeah.
Can we sit down and have a conversation before we try and slit your throat? That'd be
really right. Right.
No, it doesn't work like that. So you look like these people that we're going to attack, you get grouped in. And so all of a sudden, an immediate solidarity is kind of built in based on the fact of pure safety. And so I became really tied with a lot of the recent Latin immigrants because, if people were going to throw down, like we had to stick together, basically.
Yeah.
That was the 90s. Once I moved here to the Twin Cities, I mean, I'll never forget, like this one was really impactful. 9/11 happens. It was a huge deal, obviously, but I didn't feel anything personally. I don't mean to say that, but 9/12, the following day, I had a complete flip. Like my identity went out the window. Like, I mean, you're looking at me right now. I don't have any ties to the Middle East, but because of the way I look, I could easily be misrepresented. Or if you're an Islamophobe or a racist or a fascist and you're looking for somebody to come after, you would see my face and you would come after me, which happened. And it was a real mindfuck trip as well when that kind of stuff happened. And in a way, you know, I have a lot of friends from the Middle East and Iran and elsewhere. We have a huge Somali community here in the Twin Cities. And in some respects, I was almost happy to take some of the brunt of it to protect them because they were under a lot more fire even than I was. But that was a tough time, a really tough time. Tough to watch. I was your age, basically. I was in school. So there were some times where I was just like, I can't take a night class because I don't know what's going to happen walking back between campus and the apartment. You know what I'm saying? It was, it was tense. It was scary.
Yeah. I always am like, yes, I understand what you're saying, but obviously I don't understand in the same way. But yeah, it sounds scary.
Yeah.
And I understand what you mean by the kind of combined trauma or combined impact of being both DC and a person of color, like the combined aspect of that being like the tipping point of like I should go to therapy. Like that makes sense.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
That seems to be a lot of people's, like, the straw that, what is it, breaks the camel's back, like, where they have other stuff mm-hmm. that goes on in their lives, and then to top it off, they find out that they're donor conceived, and then it's like all hell break. Like, I've heard that from a few different people, and then you have to deal with all of the traumas at the same time.
We had started on different things, but yeah, once that cat was out of the bag, it became a very focused part of everything. I mean, and it continues to be. I shouldn't say it in past tense. It's continues to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. What else do you want to know? I have a question for you. Can I
ask? Okay, sure. Yeah.
Getting off topic a little bit. I'm a musician. I don't know if you knew that, but are you a The Police, the band, not the ACAB FTP version, but like the band, The Police? Does your name for the program come from the song, or how did
No, that's funny that you asked that though. No, I mean, you hear the term like message in a bottle. It has to do with like some, you know, like, you know, putting a message in a bottle and it actually goes somewhere, or the song, or different mm-hmm. things. But it comes from during my interview with my biological father. I was talking to him about like, when you did this, when you donated, whatever, like, what did you think would come of it? Like, did you imagine children contacting you, or did you think about it a lot after you had done it? Those kinds of questions. And he was like, it was kind of like a message in a bottle. Like, it was something good that I did that happened. And I kind of just sent it out. And, you know, you don't know if anything will ever come from it. That's kind of what he was talking about. And I was like, huh, that's an interesting sort of phrase. And in the beginning, when I started this, it wasn't like I thought it would be a thing that would be heard by people, you know, all over the world at this point, or the country or whatever. It was just, I'm handing this in for my project for school. And so I had these three episodes, and I was like, what do I call this? And then I thought about that. But no, it doesn't have to do with the with the song. It's a good song, though.
I remember that now. I mean, I've listened to everything. I'm a fan. It's coming back to me.
Yeah, no.
Listening to you, like, with your siblings, and then there's the other program, too, the Half of Me with Allie, I think is her name. Like, listening to you guys vibe with your siblings, it reminds me so much of when we're on with the other however many combination of the seven. I mean, it's a good time. It's fun, but at the same time, and you can probably relate to this too, it's so hard because you're like, you're trying to build this relationship and enter into these adult lives with all the adult stuff, and it's tricky, right? It's tough. There's no handbook for this shit.
No. Yeah. And it seems like it would be more difficult as time goes on. Like, to be 18 and to meet somebody that is your sibling, that's weird in a certain way, but then to be like in your 30s or in your 40s or even later than that, it's like you're definitely an established like person. And to kind of meet somebody that's a stranger but is also a relative, that's a weird thing. And I definitely do feel, of course, closest to my brother, who is my full sibling, but I don't think that it's because we have, you know, the same two parents. I think it's because I was raised with him, so I'll always feel differently about him compared to the sister that I met when I was 8. I feel like I know her way better than the siblings that I've met within the past few years, you know. So mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
do you see like the different dynamics of things too, where sometimes things are good and sometimes the vibes are a little bit off, and sometimes people pull away, sometimes people come back in, that kind of a thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you can tell that the group means different things to different people. Like, yeah. I have a few sisters who were raised by single moms that I feel like aren't as, who are only children also, who aren't as like invested or something, or super interested in the group. Whereas I have one of my sisters was like a later discovery, and she definitely feels differently about the group versus like our bio dad's son, who like is, you know, that's probably a weird position to be in, but he's
right. That, that, Yeah, no, I remember listening to that. I think I re-listened to that one too. I mean, that's a trip that first of all, that he's cool enough to be a part of all your lives and have that like direct connection too. Like that's kind of neat.
Yeah.
As if it weren't enough, this came out much later. So we recently got on a call with the sister of Gamete Profiteer, mm-hmm. and she was very cool, and her husband, like whatever your stereotypical 70 something older folk from the Midwest, like that's these people, but they were mm-hmm. they were very, very nice, very, very kind, very, very empathetic, and just kind of felt terrible like all the way around. But I'm projecting, probably saying that I think the dude is an asshole, and in a lot of ways I think he is. But then when I heard her like talk about her brother, I'm like, man, this guy is a motherfucker. He's a piece of shit. He's
oh, really?
Yes, like because he shunned her for like reaching out to us and having a relationship with us.
So he has no interest in
cut her off completely.
Oh, like, wow, that's family. Horrible.
Oh yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But then come to find through her that this still trips me out. So one of his social kids is here in the Twin Cities.
Oh wow.
Oh yeah.
And doesn't know about any of you.
Doesn't know about me.
Well, maybe they take a DNA test and get the sort of.
Well, and I mean there's that, but then also like, you know, the community is not huge here. I mean, it's a big metropolitan area, but with one of our groups, a couple of us sat down and just through like, you know, we're not like super hacker computer folk, but we're good enough where we can do some Googles and some cross referencing and go through social media. And I mean, within like 15 minutes, we had an address, mm-hmm. and I like mapped it out. I'm like, because I was like, you know, if they're in the suburbs or whatever, we'll probably never see each other. No, this is a place where I regularly run. This is a place where I regularly train. High foot traffic. It's like I could bike to this person's house in like maybe 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
This person that is technically my sister, my half sister. It's fucked up, man.
It's so, yeah, that because you don't know by kind of shutting it down and never telling his kids that he raised, like they could be interested in meeting any of you, but now they'll never know.
So I mean, I don't know if never, but maybe. I mean, we'll have to see how this whole thing all pans out, but at least for the time being, yeah. It's so weird and so messed up.
Yeah.
that was a more recent revelation. I'm just like, ah, oh, can we make it stop? Can we like, where's the off, you know, switch, stop valve, something?
No, I know what you mean. Yeah.
But yeah, we're getting there. It's been a journey to say the least, which again is one of the reasons I started writing, and I don't know, we'll see where that takes me, but it's been good to start to talk to. I mean, I got to the point where maybe through the writing where I started to feel more comfortable with myself and my story to speak to somebody like yourself and maybe some other folks as well. Tell my story, but then also, you know, highlight the BIPOC DCP situation as well, because it's pretty unique to say the mm-hmm. least.
Yeah, that's still definitely important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad you came on and got to talk about all this, because like I was saying, I don't think that it's a conversation that's had often enough at all. But yeah,
well, I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, it was good to meet you.
I appreciate everything you do too. I mean, honestly, it's inspiring. I know for you it started just as a school project, but I think for many of us it's to hear the voices and hear the stories, to hear your story, it's really, really nice, and it's really, really heartening in a lot of ways. And you know, and at a certain point, like, I don't want to say I'm jealous, because there's a little bit of jealousy, because like I would have loved to have those established relationships that you were able to have.
Mm-hmm.
But to then to just see how things are still kind of progressing with you and folks in your generation, it's inspiring, and it makes me feel better about kind of the shitty hand that I was dealt and a lot of us were dealt. Makes me not be so pissed at everything all the time. Don't get me wrong. I have anger issues, which is one of the reasons I like to have a heavy bag around and just go to work. but no, it's a good good positive channel as well. So thank you for all you do.
Thanks. It's been really positive for me too, because I had never really met anybody that was donor conceived besides like my family until all of this. So it's been really nice to do that, just like, you know, selfishly for me. But yeah, it's been very cool to hear from people from all over, including you.
Aw, I'm glad. Thanks.
All right.
Groovy. Yeah. And if, again, I think maybe the most important thing for any kind of a takeaway is if there is a person or persons listening that that do fall anywhere in that deep breath of DC BIPOC or BIPOC DCP, and they want to get involved or meet some more folks, we you know, open door. We'd love to embrace you and welcome you.
So how should I like link you?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, my personal, you can do the Instagram. That's Eric SB Musica, at Eric SB Musica. I don't think anybody's probably on Mastodon, but if you're on Mastodon, I'm there too. DC BIPOC. The actual group is through DCC. DCC Support, I think is what they are on Instagram, if I'm not mistaken. But any one of those avenues, and we'll get you on the path, as it were.
Awesome. Yeah. Cool. All right. I'll talk to you soon. I'll let you know.
Right on.
All right.
Well, thank you.
Bye. Thanks.
Ciao, ciao.
Okay, thank you to Eric for coming on, and the links to the DC BIPOC support group are listed in the episode description if you wanted to learn more about that. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next Thursday. Bye!